From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in New York signing an executive order on infrastructure today, and he's also speaking out against the CEOs who have left his manufacturing council. He tweeted this morning that for every CEO that leaves, I have many to take their place. He also called them grandstanders. The CEOs of Merck, Under Armour, and Intel all left that council yesterday after the president took 2 days to call out white supremacists following the weekend violence in Charlottesville. And today, Scott Paul, the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, said he would also leave the council because, quote, it's the right thing for me to do. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome back.
Good to talk to you.
So what do you make of how the president is responding to these departures, that there are CEOs who will take their place? I mean, are there CEOs that will take these guys' place?
It's not likely that there are CEOs that are either competitors to the companies that are leaving or CEOs that operate at that level who are likely to take that place, because the information we've been getting from a lot of these companies is that this manufacturing council is not doing much anyway. It ends up being a bit of a photo op for the president. So some of these CEOs have been looking for reasons not to be involved. There are always company owners and CEOs who will join a presidential panel or, frankly, take presidential appointments. But generally speaking, no, it's not a one-to-one replacement. Still, it's only been four, although the last one, Scott Paul, the Alliance of American Manufacturers, that's a big one because it's a group of a lot of different manufacturing companies that are actually in the manufacturing business. So whereas Under Armour, for instance, inadvertently manufactures, but it's a brand and it's a sporting company, the actual idea that manufacturers are leaving this council means that there may not be much left.
But the CEO of Under Armour, Kevin Plank, who stepped down, actually praised the election of President Trump after
yes.
it happened, which got him into some hot water. It's interesting that he would be one who would leave.
Right, and he got him into a lot of hot water, first of all. A lot of these CEOs have realized that politics isn't their jam. And in fact, Kevin Plank said that when he stepped out. The statement that he put out indicated that we're about sports, not politics. So they're not going to be critical of Donald Trump because they've realized the firepower that the president has. But the president did tweet at the CEO of Merck saying maybe he needs to lower drug prices now. They don't want to be involved in this. No CEO's got the marketing staff and firepower to go up against Donald Trump. So if they can get a little distance between their companies and him at the moment, they're probably more interested in taking it.
Still, there are some CEOs, many of them, who are
yep.
staying on this council. The former Clinton Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has a piece in the Financial Times today asking why all CEOs aren't resigning from this council.
Yeah, and I would predict that by the end of the week, we'll have seen more. It's always really hard to be the first, but in this case, it's going to be really hard to be the last. A number of CEOs have come out. General Electric said in a statement that they are going to continue to advise the president. It all sort of depends on what your customer base is and what your needs of the government are, right? So if you're General Electric or other companies where you might get government contracts, you don't want to run afoul of the government. If you're front-facing, meaning you've got consumers like Under Armour, your tensions may be different. And all American companies right now are contending with a low unemployment rate, which means it's hard to get workers. And what you don't want to do is alienate your working base. So I would say that every single one of those companies is probably having an internal discussion, and there are probably more to come this week.
Do we lose anything substantively by not having as many people on the manufacturing council? What are they supposed to be doing?
Yeah, not really. It's a good thing that the president wants to reach out to various constituent groups and talk about things, but President Obama did it, President Clinton did it, President Bush did it. They all do it. This is just a different structure. I mean, leaving this council isn't like leaving the UN or something like that. It's not unimportant, but there are other ways. It's not that by leaving the council, if the government needs the input of the CEO of Under Armour or Merck or Intel, they can't pick up a phone and have a conversation or set up a meeting in which they can get it. So it's not terribly consequential. It's more symbolic, but for some, it's importantly symbolic.
As we mentioned, President Trump has been lashing out at these CEOs on Twitter, but he's also been tweeting some other things that are getting even more attention. He tweeted yesterday, retweeted something from a well-known conspiracy theorist who promoted the so-called Pizzagate
yeah.
falsehood. He also retweeted and then quickly deleted an image of a Trump train running over a CNN reporter.
Yeah, and he had gotten into a spat with the CNN reporter yesterday who represented all the other reporters in the presidential pool, calling him fake news. We haven't got a straight response from the White House on this. We have an off-the-record source saying that as soon as we found out what it was deleted. But not clear. The president was on a bit of a tweet storm today, interestingly enough, not on some of the major issues like infrastructure, like the China trade stuff, but on a continuation of the Charlottesville conversation. Not clear yet.
Is it really possible that the president didn't know who he was retweeting? He doesn't often just retweet random Twitter followers.
Yeah, although these two retweets that you mentioned today were so ill-advised that one wonders. You know, nobody ever tweets my stuff, but the president is, in theory, in charge of his Twitter feed, but we do know that historically others have tweeted for him. But yeah, there's definitely a tone to this morning's tweeting that was interesting.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, today, North Korea may have blinked in its threat to attack Guam, but Iran's President Rouhani threatened to restart his country's nuclear program. Let's start with North Korea. North Korean state media said Kim Jong-un has made the decision not to attack Guam for now. After examining and praising the military plan at a command post, he did warn, however, that he could change his mind if, according to state media, the Yankees persist in their extremely dangerous, reckless actions. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Robin.
And President Trump, of course, threatened fire and fury after news that North Korea had miniaturized a nuclear weapon to fit it on a missile. North Korea then responding with that threat to attack Guam. There's been reportedly a lot of backroom tamping down of the fire and fury language in South Korea and directed to China. So do you read today's comments from Kim as the North blinking, or did the U.S. soften its image?
Well, I would be hesitant about interpreting the North's behavior as blinking, because the chief threat right here is not that North Korea is going to decide today to launch a missile at the U.S. or that hopefully the U.S. isn't going to do the same. The danger of war is not deliberate war, but war that happens through miscalculation and misperception, and where little things grow large in ways that leaders don't expect. So if we were to characterize what Kim did as blinking, some people might conclude, look, our strategy is working. We should be make more bluffing and have more over-the-top statements and impromptu nuclear doctrine. This is a strategy that's winning, and I would be reluctant to come to that conclusion. I was on this morning on a listserv of North Korea experts, and there's even among people who speak Korean and who have studied this country for many years, there's still some disagreement about what the message actually means. So let's not get ahead of ourselves. I think it's good news. Did I think North Korea was going to launch four missiles at Guam? No, because we would have responded and it would have been the end of the Kim regime. So I wasn't expecting that to happen this week or next.
But what a horrible moment when in Guam, you know, people got instructions what to do if there was a nuclear attack, including don't use hair conditioner because it will attract the radiation. I mean, just terrible moment there for
awful,
people in Guam.
But, you know, to go back to last week, and I was on vacation last week in Maine, and to paraphrase Lloyd Bridges from the classic movie Airplane, something tells me I picked the wrong week to go on vacation, because you had this fire and fury comment. Imagine if you're the president of South Korea, President Moon, and you have your ally threatening to conduct a nuclear strike that will kill your people. I mean, the missile isn't flying to Seattle. It's flying towards Seoul.
Yeah. And the president of South Korea today said, do not do anything, said to the U.S., do not do anything without consulting us.
Exactly. Makes it look weak.
How much do you think this is China putting more pressure on North Korea? It announced a ban on North Korean imports of coal, iron, and seafood. The New York Times is reporting it's in part because President Trump has pulled back on his threats of punishing China over trade, using that leverage. Of course, he loses the leverage on trade, but gains maybe China helping more with North Korea.
Well, I think certainly the latest UN security resolution goes beyond all the previous ones, and all the previous ones were the strongest ever. And China certainly has a strong interest in this not turning into war. They don't want to have a war on their border. And they have been applying pressure, particularly in areas like gasoline. So they may be working behind the scenes, but that's what the Chinese do, do it behind the scenes. And I think that's something we may want to consider doing a little more of.
Real quick. I got to ask you about Iran. Its president today warning that country could restart its nuclear program within hours. And remember, it curbed the program as part of that deal in 2015. 2015. The U.S. says Iran is violating the deal by testing ballistic missiles. The U.S. has imposed sanctions. Iran's upset about that. But suddenly we hear from Iran. Your thoughts?
Well, I think they're wholly separate issues. We haven't talked about Iran, you and I, because the Iran deal has been working. The inspectors are there. They aren't they aren't spinning centrifuges or building bombs. But the Iran deal critics have persisted and are working to overturn the deal. And President Trump on some days says he'll tear it up and on other days says he's going to think about it. So there's at least a real possibility. This show has been playing out quietly while we've been focused on North Korea. There is a real danger that come October, the president may rip up the Iran deal. And of course, Rouhani is going to suffer from that politically. The hardliners are going to lay into him about it. And so this is probably signaling on his part, not only to a domestic audience, but to the Europeans and the Americans, that you're playing with fire.
Well, again, fire, yes. And again, Iran says its ballistic missiles have nothing to do with nuclear weapons. But of course, people looking over at North Korea, their ballistic missiles are now reportedly being weaponized. Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. We love Maine. Jim, stop going to Maine. We need you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today marks 70 years since India gained its independence. After decades of oppression under colonial rule, British India was divided into India and Pakistan. You'll be hearing a lot about the so-called partition this week. But our next guest has an unusual and, for him, troubling connection to the independence movement. Justin Rowlatt is the BBC's South Asia correspondent. He joins us by Skype from Delhi. And, Justin, we were scheduled to speak with you anyway about Independence Day there in India. Then we heard your really remarkable story. Tell us about your great-grandfather, who was a part of the British colonial government.
So my great-grandfather was a judge. He actually specialized in rather arcane tax law. But in 1918, he was asked to chair a committee that investigated sedition, so kind of treasonous acts in India, at a time when India was quite unsettled. It was the very beginnings of the independence movements in India. At the end of the First World War, huge numbers of Indians had fought for Britain and had come back and were beginning to think, hold on a second, maybe, you know, we should have right. So there was this kind of anxiety and clamour for the beginnings of an independence movement. And then after the First World War ended, the British government said to him, listen, now you need to draw up a law to try and do something to tackle this. And he'd become, I think it's fair to say, quite anxious about the role that these seditionists, or whatever you want to call them, these people who were plotting against the empire. I mean, it's a complex story, but he drew up what was a very, very draconian and regressive piece of legislation. So, for example, you could be imprisoned without trial for 2 years simply for having a newspaper considered seditious by the British authorities. So it was a very, very draconian piece of legislation, and Indians were absolutely furious about it.
Because, as you say, call them seditionists or whatever you want to call them. Of course, the Indians wanted to call this an independence movement, freedom
absolutely.
Fighters. And so what was the result of the act that was passed, you know, written by your great-grandfather? What was the reaction to that?
Well, my problem is that not only was it written by him, but it took his name. So it's known as the Rowlatt Act. And it became an absolutely pivotal moment in Indian history. There was a sort of elderly generation of independence leaders who'd been dying away. And a new guy had turned up from South Africa that not many people had heard of, a guy called, at that time, just called Gandhi. So he'd arrived from South Africa. He was, you know, interested in campaigning for Indian independence. He'd successfully campaigned against the authorities in South Africa to get rights for Indian people in South Africa. And he wanted to bring some of the campaigning effort that he'd brought to India. And into his lap fell this awful bit of legislation.
So as you said, this guy named Gandhi arrives. Your great-grandfather's act gives him so much fuel behind this independence movement. But what happened in 1919?
So Gandhi launched his first campaign of nonviolence against the Rowlatt Act and said that people should demonstrate peacefully in cities around India, which they did without incident mostly, except in a town called Amritsar, which is in northern India. And there was a protest in a walled garden. And British troops came in, led by a guy called Brigadier General Dyer. He led them into the garden. There'd been an order had gone out that there would be no meetings. These guys, there were about, estimates put about 20,000 people inside this walled garden. And he'd issued an order saying no meetings, and he decided that because he'd said no meetings, he needed to send a clear message to these people that they shouldn't be protesting, and therefore he, without warning, opened fire in what was an absolutely horrific atrocity. They fired upon these men, women and children, completely unarmed, protesting non-violently. Everybody accepted that was the case. The British Investigation Inquiry subsequently agreed that these people were unarmed and were not being violent. Even Winston Churchill, a great opponent of Indian independence, and he said it was an outrageous and disgraceful act. So there was this terrible carnage. They fired for 10 minutes, literally exhausted their ammunition, and in the process, according to the British, killed 379 people, injured more than 1,000. Indian estimates put the figures higher, but everybody agrees a lot of people died. And so Amritsar became an emblem of the wickedness of the British Empire in India. And it was a kind of watershed because, I mean, as you say, it gave fuel to Gandhi's campaign. And it also persuaded, I mean, not just Indians, but people in Britain, you know, had to ask themselves, you know, who are we to commit, a horrible crime like this? So both in India and in Britain, it forced people to think, well, you know, what is the justice of empire? And began the unification of the Indian people about the idea of independence and the need to free themselves from British imperialism.
So you went back to that town where that garden was. You met a descendant of a man who'd been in the garden that day. He, this descendant, took you into this garden where that horrible massacre happened. First of all, let's hear a little bit of this man showing you around.
I can show you the bullet marks, which will show you that his aim was to kill the public.
So what happened to your grandfather?
He escaped.
He just lay down and avoided the firing?
Yeah.
How long did the shooting last?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Continuously firing?
Yeah.
At unarmed men,
totally
women, and
unarmed
children?
Totally unarmed.
Men, women and children?
Yeah. Totally unarmed.
Oh, God.
Is that you, Justin, saying, oh, God?
Yeah, that was me. I know. I found it a very, really quite difficult. It actually makes me upset even to think about it. Now I find it a very upsetting to go back there and feel an association. Even, I mean, it's vicarious. You know, it's he's my great grandfather. I never knew him. I never knew my grandfather either. You know, so the connection is very distant. But you know, the act that they were demonstrating against was, you know, written and named after a direct relative of mine, and you couldn't help but go there and feel shame and guilt about what happened. Indeed, most British people who visit there, I think, find it a difficult and very moving place to go to.
Do you need a second?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm fine. Go on, Robin.
Well, it's quite profound. And one would expect, since you are the descendant of the man who wrote this act that led to this massacre, you would be driven out. How were you received?
I mean, with dignity. I mean, I was welcome. The guy that you heard there, S.K. Mukherjee, said his grandfather was there during the massacre, and he was actually, the British wanted to knock the garden down, and he petitioned. He led a huge petition and said, we must buy this land and it must be preserved so that there's always a memory of what happened there. So he's directly responsible for the garden still being there. He said, you obviously feel shame, and therefore I feel no anger towards you, which is, I thought, a very generous emotion to feel. But I have to say that's been replicated by literally every Indian I've ever spoken to about this. Nobody has had any hostility or anger or rancor towards me because of it. They're interested because the Rowlatt Act is part of the basic history syllabus for all Indians to learn about the Rowlatt Act because it was so pivotal.
It's not just that they had such forgiveness for you, but in at least one case, and one important one, there was almost gratefulness. Let's listen to an exchange you had with a descendant of Mahatma Gandhi. This is his great-grandson, Tushar Gandhi. You expected him, of all people, to be angry with you, but this is what he actually said.
The beauty of the Rowlatt Act was that he didn't have to be a spin doctor to make people understand that it was unjust.
Tell us more about what he meant by that. It's almost as if, you know, your great-grandfather's act was so bad.
That's exactly what he was saying. When I met him, he said, thank you. And I said, you know, I don't know how to take this. What do you mean? And he said, thank you for putting the first nail in the coffin of the British Empire. He meant the legislation was so manifestly unjust that his great-grandfather, Mahatma, as he became the Mahatma Gandhi, he found it very easy to protest against. He said even, you know, an ordinary, uneducated Indian could see just how unjust this act was, and therefore he could unify India around it. And I think what Gandhi found was that in the Rollout Act and in his subsequent protest, because it was the beginning, obviously, of a many, many years of protest and a series of huge kind of marches and stuff that he led, that he could unify India around this idea.
Well, and here we have Independence Day. There's going to be a lot of reporting as well on the divide, Pakistan cleaved from India. But how is, I mean, what's this like for you to be there as this huge country? Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, it's a fascinating time to be in India, particularly with my heritage. I mean, as I say, I've been stunned by the kind of generosity of people not feeling hostility towards me for what my relatives did. But it's also, I have to say, it's a really exciting time to be in India generally. You know, India's the second most populous country in the world. It's a country that is, you know, really finding itself in the world now. It's growing rapidly. It grows about 7% a year on average. It's the fastest growing large economy in the world. And in a sense, it's doing what China, the process that China began back in the 1980s. India is now growing kind of inexorably to take its natural place in the world. A country as big and populous as this will be a huge force internationally. So it's a really exciting time to be here as India, post-independence India kind of comes of age. That's what you feel. So it's an amazing place to be on the 70th anniversary of independence.
Justin Rowlatt, the BBC South Asia correspondent, speaking to us from Delhi. And Justin, I have to tell you, I've always enjoyed your reporting. I'll hear it with a different ear now, it's in a much deeper way. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
A crowd of people gathered in downtown Durham, North Carolina last night to witness the toppling of a longtime Confederate monument by protesters who pulled down the statue with a rope. On Twitter, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper called the Charlottesville violence unacceptable, but also said, quote, "There's a better way to remove these monuments." Protesters said destroying the monument was their answer to the deadly attack in Charlottesville. Leonita Inge from Here and Now contributor WUNC reports.
The crowd outside the old Durham County Courthouse on East Main Street started off small but began to grow, peaking when the bronze statue of an armed, uniformed soldier wearing a hat fell to the ground. And it was all caught on video. Hours after the event, people were still gathering, like Leslie Sumter, who was driving home from work when her son called.
I thought the house was on fire. Like, Mom, the statue is down. They're protesting downtown. Let's go.
But when I got home, my husband said, oh, no, we're not going down there based on what happened in Charlottesville.
In Charlottesville, 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when a man rammed his car into a crowd protesting a white nationalist rally. But Sumter made her way to downtown Durham anyway and was shocked when she saw the bent-up statue on the ground.
Wait, y'all kidding.
They attached the rope, and that's part of the rope still on it.
Wait, this wasn't just here?
No, that was up there.
Yeah, it was at the top.
You are kidding me.
And you see the rope is still there. They attached the rope. They had a ladder. They went up it. They attached the rope, and they took it down. This is one old gray dead soldier.
Jacqueline Wagstaff was inside the old county courthouse at a commission meeting when she heard about what was going on. She's glad to see part of the 15-foot Confederate memorial gone, but wonders why it took so long.
With all this going on about these Confederate monuments across the United States, why are progressive county commissioners haven't had this discussion about removing this a long time ago?
Rochelle Sparko says she wondered the same thing. She walked from her nearby home to see for herself that the statue had come down.
a thing that exists in our town that's bothered me since I moved here. And, you know, but it was always kind of, oh, well, that sucks that that's there. And you never really felt like there was a lot that at least I could do about it.
It's about time that statue came down.
What did you think about it when you walked
by? It represents a lie.
Pierre Faulkner and about 30 others cheered as Durham County crews detached the fallen soldier from a large piece of granite and drove it away. One staff person said they think the piece that fell down could weigh as much as 1,000 pounds. The tallest part of the monument that reads, "In Memory of the Boys Who Wore the Gray," still stands, where it was erected in 1924. For Here and Now, I'm Leonita Inge in Durham, North Carolina.
So next Monday, the event that those who've seen one say will bring you to your knees in awe, make crickets chirp in the middle of the day, the total solar eclipse. Some people are paying $35,000 for a day-long plane ticket and an unobstructed view. At Sky Village in Arizona, every resident has pledged to use blackout shades to get the full effect. But what did people think before science could predict an eclipse and the sky suddenly went dark? Brian Brewer addresses that question and more in his book, Eclipse. Brian, welcome.
It's nice to be here.
Well, as we're going to hear, people reacted in all different ways when a total solar eclipse happened. But when was the first reference to a solar eclipse that we know?
Well, it was about 4,000 years ago in China. There was the Chinese astronomers kept accurate records. We have our first actual documentation of an eclipse. I think it was 2134.
2134 BCE.
Correct.
And from the writings that we found, it says the sun and the moon did not meet harmoniously. This was not thought to be a good thing.
Definitely not. In ancient times, in Chinese cultures and many other cultures around the world, eclipses were viewed as omens of doom. This was a negative message.
Well, and there was a lot of thinking that a dragon, I think, was eating the sun.
Yes, and the same thing goes with a lunar eclipse. They applied the same mythology to lunar eclipses as well.
Talk more about other places in the world and their importance in the history of eclipses. Stonehenge was actually thought to be, what, an early sort of stone computer?
Yes. Most people, when they see Stonehenge or read about it or see pictures, they focus on the stones that are in the center of the monument. But surrounding the monument are a ring of 56 holes in the ground that are filled with chalk. They're evenly spaced holes. Amateur astronomer John Aubrey discovered these, and in the mid-20th century, several astronomers came up with a theory about how these 56 holes could have been used as a sort of a big cosmic clock, you might say, that's laid out on the ground. By moving stones around to mark the movement of the sun and the moon and the nodes of the lunar orbit, you could predict when an eclipse occurs.
Yeah. How many years ago, and even if it was crude, were scientists or astronomers able to predict an eclipse?
Well, the Chinese mentioned earlier, 2000 BCE, and as well as the Babylonian astronomers kept very accurate records about the movements of celestial objects. The Babylonians, in the same general time frame, were able to come up with this 18-year Saros, S-A-R-O-S, Saros cycle that astronomers even use today to predict the recurrence of eclipses. But predictions have been somewhat crude until the middle of the 1800s. Before that, astronomers could get a general sense of maybe what day an eclipse was going to occur, but didn't have much information about where you were going to be able to see a total solar eclipse. That all changed in the mid-1800s when several things happened. There was a mathematician who came up with some equations that make it much easier to calculate the orbital motion of the moon and the sun, of the Earth, to be able to predict eclipses. And then another astronomer spent most of his adult lifetime calculating the paths for total solar eclipses for a period of about 3,000 years. His name is Theodor von Oppolzer, and he published his Canon of Solar Eclipses in the late 1800s. And with that change, astronomers and the public as well, who had access to that information, were able to get a much better prediction of when and where a total solar eclipse was going to occur.
Yeah. Talk about some of the impacts of ancient eclipses. I mean, I can't imagine what people thought. And you say that the most famous eclipse of ancient times ended a war.
That's right. In 585 BC, there were two Middle Eastern armies, the Lydians and the Medes. They were in battle one day, and unbeknownst to them in advance, they were right in the path of a total solar eclipse that day. And so when the moon covered the sun and it went dark, the warring factions took note and they laid down their arms and they made peace right on the spot.
By the way, you tell us that those fighters not only put down their weapons and had a peace treaty, but they sealed it with a double marriage.
A double marriage, yes.
That's how freaked they were. But you write the lunar eclipse in 413 BCE had a different outcome on the Peloponnesian War.
Yes. In that case, on one side, the astronomers predicted that there was going to be a lunar eclipse, and the Athenians took it as a bad sign, and so they delayed their preparations for war, which gave the opposing side, the Syracusans, a chance to regroup, and then the Syracusans defeated the Athenians. So in that case, the military commander hesitated and lost.
Because he listened to a soothsayer.
Exactly.
We told him to wait. You say we've been able to verify for certain the date of an eclipse mentioned in the Bible.
Yes, it's from Amos chapter 8, verse 9 that says, "And on that day, says the Lord God, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight." Based on other information about what was going on at the time, historians were able to go back in time and they were able to fix the date as June 15th, 763 BCE.
Wow.
And even today, as new historical records come to light that mention eclipses, it's kind of like a time marker that we have for over the millennia. And historians have found it very useful to go back and fix the dates and get a better idea of the chronology of certain events.
It's really interesting to see how some of the ancient bleeds into the modern, because you said you went to Brazil once.
I led an eclipse tour to Brazil in 1994, and we chose a location kind of out in the countryside. And I was up on a little hill during totality, and sure enough, we could hear in the distance gunshots. And the locals said, "We're firing the guns to scare the dragon away so that the sun will come back." Hmm. And so those beliefs and customs survive even today.
And Christopher Columbus used what he knew would be beliefs to his advantage.
Yes. On his fourth voyage to the Americas, this was in 1504, he got stranded in Jamaica. The natives fed him and his crew for a while, but after a few months, they got tired of it and withheld the food. Columbus knew from his navigational and astronomical tables that there was going to be a total lunar eclipse, and this was on February 29th, 1504. And so shortly before the beginning of the eclipse, he called the natives together and said, "Hey, if you don't resume feeding us, I'm going to make the moon disappear." And they scoffed at him at first, but then he retired to his cabin, and sure enough, the moon started to disappear, and the natives relented. They fed him until he got rescued by the other ships from Europe.
That doesn't seem quite fair, but...
Well, that's the power of knowledge.
Well, you know, speaking of which, eventually, eclipses helped us learn more about our universe. You say the eclipse helped prove Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yes. One of the things he postulated in his theory was that light would be bent by gravity. Back then, there was no way to test it on Earth. But they realized that during a total solar eclipse, the light coming from a star that was very near the apparent location of the sun in the sky would actually be bent by passing next to the sun. And you could measure its location during an eclipse. And then months later, when the moon was in a different part of the sky, they could measure, again, the relative position of the star, and sure enough, they proved that the position changed, and it was changed just according to what Einstein calculated. So it was the first empirical proof of the theory of relativity.
There you go. So there's that. But why else does this have such a hold on us? There's a section of your book titled "The Experience of Awe."
Robin, that's a great question because I have been thinking about that for decades. And in the last 10 or 15 years, psychologists have begun to study this emotion called awe. And awe is certainly something that eclipse chasers know about. For one, the view of the solar corona is just magnificent. Secondly, this eerie daytime darkness is it's just really strange. Mm-hmm. And third, I think that often people get kind of a visceral sense of this cosmic alignment. You're standing right in the shadow of the moon where the, you know, with the sun 93 million miles away, the moon 240,000 miles away, and it's casting this narrow band of shadow right in the earth. And you're standing right there. So you're in perfect alignment on a truly cosmic scale.
So where are you going to be?
We have plans to be in Sun Valley, Idaho, which is in the path of totality. One piece of advice I'd like to give people who are going to be in the path of totality is don't try to use your smartphone camera to try to take a picture of the eclipse. It will be very unsatisfying. It'll be just a little tiny dot on the screen. What I tell people is the best way to use your smartphone is right after totality. Take short videos to record people's reactions because most people just typically get blown away by it.
You'll see it in their face. Brian Brewer, his book is Eclipse, the third edition. He's the go-to guy for eclipse watching, and we really appreciate you looking backwards for us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
A new study in Kentucky is raising alarms about teens' mental health in the state. The biannual study found that 8.2% of Kentucky high school sophomores had attempted suicide in the past year. For sixth graders, that rate was 4.2%. The study, called the Kentucky Incentives for Prevention Survey, found increases in every age group it looked at. Joining us now is Dr. Julie Serrell, a professor at University of Kentucky's College of Social Work and president of the American Association of Suicidology. Dr. Serrell, welcome.
Thanks.
And put these numbers in perspective for us. Is that a high rate in your view? It surprises me, 8.2%. Is it a number that's going up, or do we know how it compares to previous years?
Kentucky is in the top 20 of the states in terms of our overall rate of suicide. We're seeing a lot of increases in the suicide rate overall, as well as the rate in teenage girls. But what we don't know is, are these really genuine increases, or are people seeing more images of suicide, talking about suicide more in the media and the press, and so they're more willing to disclose their true attempts?
Why do you think that these numbers are as high as they are?
I think suicide is never due to a single cause. And so things like the opioid epidemic, poverty, lack of access to good mental health care, all contribute to people who are feeling suicidal, feeling like there's no way out, and making a plan or an attempt.
Are there any aspects of what's going on that are unique to Kentucky?
I think they're not unique specifically to Kentucky, but they are unique to rural states like ours, where there is an increase in opioid use and opioid overdose and decrease in access to mental health services, as well as access to firearms and other lethal methods of suicide.
Are there specific groups of teens that are more prone to suicidal inclinations?
I think the data is really mixed about which teens are most at risk. We know that girls attempt suicide more than boys. But overall, the rates of suicide, more men die by suicide than women, about 4 to 1. Some of that has to do with lethal means, so that when men or boys attempt suicide, often it's with a firearm. Women do use firearms, and they're still, I believe, the number one or number two cause of death in suicides in women. But they're also more likely to use means from which they can be rescued, overdose, cutting, or jumping.
So when you say that firearms are so important in all of this, are there people in Kentucky right now talking about restricting access to firearms as a result of that, that maybe that's part of the problem?
I think the discussion about firearms is a really complicated one, obviously. But what we found over the last few years is there's a lot of groups that are working with the firearms industry and with gun clubs and saying, we don't want to reduce access. We just want to make it so that people don't die by suicide with a firearm. The vast majority of people, even people who are staunch gun advocates, people don't want people to use firearms to kill themselves.
What about the status right now of mental health services across Kentucky? If a young person tells his or her parents that they're feeling depressed or anxious, how hard is it for them to get counseling or medical treatment?
I think access is a really difficult issue anywhere in the U.S. right now, but especially in rural parts of states like Kentucky. Despite their best efforts, there just aren't enough clinicians who are well-trained and who have the ability to treat kids with a variety of forms of insurance. And I think funding for suicide prevention in the United States is unfortunately in the same boat as funding for healthcare.
So what can be done by schools and educators to help students who may be struggling and might not even be showing it?
Well, there have been a lot of really good programs that have been done in schools, some of which have been done in Kentucky through Garrett Lee Smith grants, as well as other funding sources. So some of that is called gatekeeper training, where they teach people who are not mental health clinicians, so the coaches, the people in the lunchroom, the bus drivers, to really notice if a child is acting differently than usual and ask them, hey, are you thinking about suicide? And parents really shouldn't be afraid to ask if their child is acting different from normal. Hey, are you thinking about killing yourself? Let's figure out a way to get you some help.
But I imagine a lot of parents would be afraid to ask that question.
It's a really scary conversation to have. But there's a lot of evidence that shows that asking anyone, are you thinking about suicide, isn't suddenly going to put the thought into their head. Actually, someone asking them can be something of a relief, like, oh, I'm not the only one in the world who could be having these feelings.
That's Dr. Julie Serrell, who's a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Social Work and president of the American Association of Suicidology. Dr. Serrell, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And this note, we're learning more about the 20-year-old man accused of plowing a car into a crowd of counter-protesters in Charlottesville last weekend. James Fields grew up in Kentucky, failed to make it through basic training after joining the military, and worked as a security guard in Ohio. We'll have a profile later today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.